So it's my pleasure to introduce Manoj Kapurka, who's visiting us from UC Irvine. Manoj got his PhD in 99, then he did postdoc at the University of Chicago at Davis. And then since 2004, he's been a faculty at UC Irvine. So Manoj has done extensive work in very different areas in cosmology, ranging from Big Bang to synthesis to cosmic microwave background, strong gravitational lensing. But then he's made his big enterprise in connecting the financial crisis to cosmology. And of course, we're yet to figure out whether that enterprise might be too big to fail. But then he's going to tell us about that.
Wow, that's well done.
So he's going to be here for a few weeks. His office on the third floor, somewhere in the middle of the new extension. So go and find him whenever you can.
Okay, thanks, Niyash. Yeah, so my office is 369. If the door is open, please come in. So I'm going to talk about dark matter densities on small scales. This is something that was a hot topic when I was a grad student. And of late, it's come back alive. And so the first few slides, I'm going to try and walk you through what I think are sort of the key observations that's motivating a fresh look at this problem. And then as I go through the talk, I'm going to try and like connect this to dark matter models. Depending on how time goes, we might get to the indirect detection part. So what I definitely want to do are cover bullet points 1 and 2. The rest of them, you know, just if we have time and we can discuss them offline. So I'll first go through sort of the estimated dark matter densities. So I'm going to look at three systems, clusters, spiral galaxies, and Milky Way satellites. They range in mass from clusters, you know, 10 to the 15 solar masses down to Milky Way satellites, and depending on how you define these masses, down to 10 to the 9 solar masses. So it's about 6 orders of magnitude in sort of the halo mass. And the regions where you're going to be interested in are really small. So for the Milky Way satellites, it's going to be below a kiloparsec. For spiral galaxies, it's going to be of the order of kiloparsec to a few kiloparsecs. Then when you get to clusters, it's tens of kiloparsecs. Almost invariably, if you go beyond these scales, everything is consistent with the standard cold dark matter models. It's only when you start probing deeper inside that you see some hints of deviations. Okay. In particular, for the Milky Way satellites, there was an interesting observation we made recently about the massive subhalos in these CDM simulations. So I'll go through that and I'll try to motivate exactly what, you know, why we think it's a problem and what exactly the problem is. It's actually a fairly subtle issue. And then, like I said, if you have time, we'll discuss the indirect detection part, which is directly connected to these Milky Way satellites. So just to set the scale, this is something that, this is a plot of the size and velocity. So what's plotted here is if you look at a given halo and just plot square root of gm over r, that's v, and then just find the place where the velocity maximizes. So that's v max. Okay, that's, you know, typically for people who do numerical simulations or galaxy simulation, v max is an important quantity because it's a proxy for the mass, and in many cases, it, you know, in almost all cases, it can be measured better than the mass. Okay, so think of v max as just a proxy for how massive the halo is. R max is that place where you get the maximum velocity, right? So sort of, this sort of gives you sort of the size and mass of a halo. And in particular, I think for most of the models you're going to look at, even if you're not looking at cold dark matter, they're going to roughly give you the same R max, V max relation. Okay? And that's mainly because of observational reasons. You don't want to muck around with this too much because we know that on large scale, CDM works really well. So as an example, if you're out on cluster scales, you're looking at, you know, close to 500 kiloparsec, maybe a little more. You know, these are Milky Way size halos, and so on. Okay, down here are the satellites. 20 to 50 kilometers per second. These are sort of the spiral galaxies we'll discuss. The spiral galaxies obviously range over a larger range. I mean, it's our own galaxy somewhere around there. Okay, so satellites, spirals, and clusters. So let's start with the biggest ones. And these are some recent results that have been coming out in the last couple of years from a group actually in Southern California, Caltech and Santa Barbara. And what they had been doing is trying to look at a cluster in a holistic manner. So they're combining measurements of weak lensing, strong lensing, and looking at the kinematics of stars in the centers. And what they're able to do is then derive a mass profile, so how the mass changes as a function of radius. And amazingly enough, they can go down to really small scales. For clusters, 10 kpc is like really, really small scales, right? I mean, these things, you're looking at like 1% of the virial radius of a cluster. So this is maybe a cleaner plot to see. This here is the slope of the density profile. So for example, if the density goes as 1 over r, then that's NFW, that's that line, 1. And if you can't see from the back, this is 0.8, 0.6, 0.4, 0.2. Okay, so this would be a density profile here would be something that's completely flat, a density profile that doesn't change as you go into the center. And this would be consistent with an NFW density profile. And so for this one massive cluster, ABEL-611, reasonably close and something you can study in great detail, what they find is the slope is consistently below 1. On the x-axis, they've plotted sort of the size that Rmax I told you about. It's not really important. It doesn't matter what you choose for Rmax, they find something consistently less than 1, okay, less steep. So this is one cluster.
So what is the slope again? It's a linear relation between?
So the slope is just, is there a chalk here? Yeah, there is. So the slope is, the density goes as 1 over r raised to what they're calling beta. Okay. So essentially, beta is 1 that looks like the NFW profile. So the typical cold dark matter profiles look like 1 over r some scale radius. Right. So if you go into the central parts, it looks like 1 over r. Okay. And that's really sort of the what most of these observations are trying to do. And on the top here is another cluster. I couldn't find a cleaner plot. But again, that's the slope, and 1 is there. And most of their region that's favored is below 1. Okay. So these are new techniques, new observations. But you should pay attention to this. I'm sure there'll be more of these coming online in the next few years. Okay. So almost all the action here that's actually creating these contours are happening on 20, 30, 40 kiloparsec scales. So really close in the center. Okay. So another way to look at this is that if you go to small scales like 20, 30 kiloparsecs, then what they're saying is this profile gets modified. It's not as steep as this NFW profile. Okay, so that was clusters. Yeah.
It might be worth mentioning for some of the others that NFW is what you get from dark matter simulations.
That's right. So, yeah. So this is the form you get from dark matter simulations. Except the highest resolution simulation tend to show that it doesn't really go as 1 over r. It tends to sort of become a little less steep as you go in. But for the scales we are interested in, the NFW profile is always a reasonable fit in the simulation, in the CDM simulations. Okay, so the next thing is spiral galaxies. Oh, these things are really not coming out well. Okay, so now I don't know if it's, yeah, if you can turn off these lights. So this is a plot of the density versus radius, okay? And then the colored points are essentially data from seven nearby galaxies. So these are all very close by. And they you have to cherry pick them, because if they're not close by, you can't really probe the central path, right? They have to be reasonably big on the sky. So they're all fairly close by, less than 5 megaparsecs. They're all very low in baryons, very low gas and stars, and very small amount of gas and stars in them. It's mostly dark matter dominated. And their velocities that Vmax I was putting up is in the 30 to 100 kilometer per second range. Okay, so if you sort of scale them all by their size and put them all on one plot, it looks like this, and your eyes can follow these colored points. And the main thing to note is that the NFW profile is that other line up there, which in the inner parts is that line. Okay, and so this is saying the same thing that the clusters are saying, is that if you go close to the center, there's less dark matter than you would predict from dark matter simulations.
So is Vmax the escape velocity, or?
Is related to the escape velocity, but it's just the square root of gm over r. Right. So Vmax is just the max of square root of gm over r. This plot is very similar to this one, except what's plotted here is the log slope of the density profile. So this is what's plotted is d log rho, d log r. Okay. So again, if it was NFW profile, you should get a minus one here. So this line here is the NFW profile. So these two are just different ways of looking at it. And then there's a whole bunch of data here, not just from them, but from other nearby galaxies, and they all sort of, in this region, scatter up. Okay, and in this plot, scattering up means the density profile is getting flat. Okay, so what we've seen in the last slide and what you're seeing here is the same thing. If you go close to the center, there's less dark matter, and dark matter doesn't rise as fast as 1 over r. Okay, and I don't think there's any way to get around these observations now. They've been around for a long time. I mean, you know, since I would say early 2000, these things have been, you've observed many, many of these galaxies, and in the galaxies where you can go, you know, very close to the center and try to measure these slopes, it always looks like the slope comes out less than the NFW profile.
So,
yeah?
So how do you measure density in the density of dark matter?
These things are fairly, well, not fairly, but these things are fairly simple because they're spiral galaxies, so you can actually measure the line of sight velocity and then just back out just V squared equals GM over R from these.
That parts are in the bulge of the galaxy, or in the spiral?
No, in most cases, these things are pretty small bulges, but the observations go out from the central parts all the way, you know, 3 or 4 optical radii. So even close to the bulge, I think like 5 of these 7 galaxies are completely dark matter dominated.
Comment.
Is that, yeah?
If you just plot the luminous Newtonian expectation in the inner region for these things, galaxies, the data are way above it. That means there has to be something going on in the inner region. And this is a model for what might be.
Is that what you were asking? I mean, if you're asking if they're dark matter dominated in the center, they are. No, that's in our galaxy. It's not in all galaxies, right?
They don't have dwarfs.
So these things are like...
These are basically dwarf spirals. There's almost no structure in the center. And that's why they're so clean for this particular test.
So you have to cherry pick them. I mean, that's the problem. You have to find these like special things. But the problem is if you don't find the special things, then it's not that, you know, that... You really don't know anything about the dark matter in the center because it's so hard to infer it, right? So again, that's why whenever you look at these kinds of plots, you always see a handful of points because you have to look for these things close by. They have to be dark matter dominated, and most spirals are not like that. Probably as a more visceral example, here's like 9 of them. And you don't need to read anything in this. What I want you to take away from this is just one thing, which is, so what this is plotting is velocity as a function of radius. So So 50, 100 kilometers, and here's kiloparsec. Just note that almost all of these things in the inner regions show a linear rise. Right? And some of them you can't quite see, but you know, most of them you can see that there's a linear rise in the center. And if velocity goes linearly with radius, that means density has to be flat. Right? So just by looking at this by eye, you can figure out that in the central parts, the density has to just flatten off. And again, these are really very high resolution observations, and they're all less than about 10 megaparsecs. They're very close by. Okay, so this basically, so I'm going to next talk about the satellites. But before I do that, I want to stop here and ask.
But the scales here in this linear rise are very different.
Yeah, the scales are, that's good to note. Yes, they are very different. In some cases, they are below a KPC. In other cases, they go out to like 3 or 4 KPC. And that's something that we'll need to like keep in mind. So it's a factor of 10 almost scatter in this.
Just looking at some of these plots, I think there's a very clear systematic correlation between subsequent points. So how should I interpret all of these independent data points? For example, the lower left, clearly a strong correlation.
Yeah, and
so the linearize there is not very convincing. But in the other ones, how should I interpret?
You know, you're on. So I have asked this the observers who do this. I have often told them this, that if you look at any of these, so what was just told is that if you look at any of these plots, you can clearly see all the points are going up and down together, right? They're all correlated, right? There aren't these many independent data points in here. And I think this is because of the way they do the observations, the tilted ring analysis. It just correlates all the points. Ideally, what I would like them to do is to just give me the raw 2D velocity profile so you can go and fit a model rather than doing this historical thing where you're plotting a rotation curve and then trying to infer the model parameters from it. Yeah, so I don't have a good answer to this. But this, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that regardless of what you do, there's a clear, you know, you might be talking about 5 sigma versus 3, but there's a whole bunch of these galaxies there. So this has to be done, I would say, in a better way. But it's very clear that in the central parts, the density is flat. Okay, so I'm going to do the first sort of deviation from CDM in the next slide. So one way in which you could, and this is again historically the way that a lot of people have thought about this, you could explain a flat density is by saying that it's dark matter that sets the density in the center. That there's something that prevents the dark matter from clustering and creating a density higher than a certain value. And we know something that does it. It's just warm dark matter. So if you take dark matter that has some temperature primordially, then it has a certain phase space density, right? And collisionless evolution can never exceed that. Right? As long as everything is collisionless, you can never exceed it, which means, as was shown in 1979 by Tremaine and Gunn, in the central parts, there should be a maximum density. So let's ask if this is really consistent with that picture. Okay. So now we're throwing out cold dark matter. We're saying that dark matter is some warm particle. And we're quantifying how warm it is by its initial phase space density. Okay. So this is one prediction for a particle. It has a certain phase space density. The value is not that important right now. This is another prediction. What's plotted here is the core radius in kiloparsecs, 2, 4, 6, 8, versus the total mass of the system, 10 to the 10 solar mass, 10 to the 11 solar masses. And these are, I think, 7, again, high-resolution galaxies. Two things you'd want to take away from this. One is that it doesn't really follow the trend you expect for warm dark matter. It just looks like a scatter plot. Okay, but that's not the that's not the really important thing. The really important thing is, this number here, the phase space density, is something like 10 raised to minus 9. Okay. It's really very astrophysical units, but it's a small number in terms of so this is space-based density, so it's mass density over velocity cube, right? So it's solar masses per parsec cube, 1/km/s³. This phase-space density, if you created any warm dark matter with this phase-space density, you wouldn't produce any structure. Okay, you wouldn't produce structure on these scales. It would just get wiped out because it's too warm. Okay, and there are constraints coming from Lyman alpha forests and other constraints that rule this out by orders of magnitude. So what this plot is telling you is that you could produce those cores that we saw with warm dark matter, but in order to do so, you would have to create something so warm that it's inconsistent with the large-scale structure properties. Okay, and you can try to get around this; it's just very difficult, right? So this isn't telling you that in the real world dark matter isn't warm. All this is saying is those cores you see in the previous plot are not set by this primordial phase space limit. Okay, it's not a direct result of warm dark matter. So whenever people talk about warm dark matter, if you're in a talk, make sure you mention this. You know that it's not easy to actually get these large cores in how do you actually get kiloparsec size cores in a 10 to the 10 solar mass galaxy? Okay, one more thing, and this is something you mentioned, that there's a lot of scatter in these things. So if I plot the density in the center as a function of this, again, this Vmax, which is just a proxy for the mass, you can see, and don't forget about sort of what the symbols mean, but it's just that you can see that these galaxies scatter over a large range. It's almost a factor of 10 scatter. Okay, it's a scatter not just in core size, but also in core densities. Okay, so whatever it is that's creating this, you need to be able to actually predict not just the exact values, but also the scatter. Okay, so the question I'm asking here is, does this look like the prediction of self-interacting dark matter model? Because when you move away from cold dark matter and you're still thinking about dark matter, there's two generic ways in which you can break it. You can think about adding a temperature, so you can create warm dark matter. Right? Cold dark matter essentially means something that's primordially completely cold, has no thermal velocities, and it doesn't interact with itself. So you can break it by doing two things. You can create warm dark matter, or you can make it interact with itself. You can also try and make it interact with other stuff, and there's constraints coming from the CMB. You can try to make it interact with the baryons or electrons. You have a hard time playing that game. So reasonably speaking, these are probably the two things you can do, whereby you're just adding one parameter to the theory: the primordial temperature or the strength of the self-interaction. And in the previous slide, I tried to motivate that, you know, the warm dark matter, there's no natural way of explaining the spiral galaxies. So once we finish looking at the Milky Way satellites, we'll come back to this question about, can self-interacting dark matter do the job? Okay. So this is the third thing that I was going to tell you about, Milky Way satellites. Any questions about the previous two? So we moved from clusters to spiral galaxies, and now we're coming down to the smallest guys, which are the satellites of the Milky Way.
If I may ask a question. So in principle, baryons could be responsible for doing this damage. It's just that we don't see them because maybe they're in the moon. So for example, if you have very strong feedback, either through supernova or AGN, they could flatten the dark matter and push all the baryons out.
Yeah, so we'll come to that. I have a slide on that. So when we get there, we should discuss this. Yeah. So I've been reasonably careful in saying these are predictions of dark matter, you know, only simulations. When you put feedback in, things can change. But I think the linchpin then is the Milky Way satellites. Okay. So this is just a summary of the Milky Way satellites, and it's already, I think, it's probably not outdated. So what's plotted here, just to give you an idea, is the visible luminosity, log of that. So this is 100 solar mass, solar luminosities, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, million, 10 million solar luminosities. Okay. So it's important to keep in mind that these things are very, very faint. the brightest of the dwarf satellites is about 10 million solar luminosity. Okay. And it's plotted as a function of the distance from the center of the halo, not particularly important. What's important to note is that the red ones were all discovered before the Sloan. The green ones were all discovered in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and you can clearly see why. Right. So this is what there's a lot of work that's gone on, and there's a lot of work I've done, you know, in terms of trying to prove that, you know, a bunch of these green blobs here are actually galaxies. But what we'll do is just stick with the red ones that are, you know, fairly well known. There's pretty large data sets for them. And that's what we'll use to sort of define this too big to fail problem. Okay, yeah, so whenever I say bright, I just mean the red ones, the ones discovered before Sloan came along. So so here's one slide on the mass estimates. This is, I think in some sense, this is harder than the spiral galaxies, although I'm not as hard as doing the clusters. So there's a whole section on like mass modeling later on if you get to it. But here, what I want you to take away is that the data normally comes in this fashion, where you just go out and measure velocities of stars in a small region of the sky. Okay, that region is coincident with where you think a new galaxy is. And where you think the new galaxy is a little bit of an art. There are people who perfected this art, and they keep finding new ones. So basically, they look at color magnitude diagrams and make this case that there's a clump there, which you can never see with your own eye. But there is a clump there. That looks like a galaxy, and then you spend an enormous amount of time going to something like a Keck telescope and measuring velocities of stars in that clump, and then this is something which you get. And this is one of the particularly hard cases. It's Segway 1. It's the least luminous. It's about 300 solar luminosities, the best you can estimate. It might be a little higher, but of that order. Okay. And what you can clearly see is that there's a bump here. That's mostly the Milky Way. And there's a sharp peak here with a very small dispersion, and that's your galaxy. Okay? Even the blind should pick that out. Right? So that's Segway 1. And now the job is to like take that, clean it up, and then try to figure out what the mass is. Okay? And there's been some work here which shows that, you know, you can take these kinds of systems with hundreds of stars. And estimate the mass within the half-right radius of the star. So within the region where most of the stars are, you can estimate that reasonably well. Most of the work has been done assuming spherical symmetry. But towards the end, I'll show you a bunch of stuff that relaxes those constraints. So for example, for Segway 1, when you do this, what you find is so this plot is actually kind of interesting. So let me just say this, because it set my thinking for a couple of years. This is a plot where I'm putting all the Milky Way satellites. And what I'm plotting is the measured density. So you take the mass within sort of the optical radius, divide by the volume of the optical radius, so you get the average density of dark matter in that region. That's plotted on the y-axis, and sorry for the log units, but this is just log of that density. And what's plotted on the x-axis is essentially the optical radius, the half-light radius of the stars, so where the region where most of the stars are. And you can just plot all the different satellites. Okay, this dashed line is basically just take a very generic subhalo from a lambda CDM simulation. I just plot it, and you see how beautifully it goes through it. Okay. And really, when I, you know, this plot really did make an impact on me, and you know, I started thinking, well, you know, if it really looks so good on small scales, you know, maybe this is it. Maybe, you know, dark matter is a whim. Okay. But that plot, in fact, is the problem, as I'll try to show you in the next slide. Okay. And if you're from, there was in 2008, we had this paper. About all the satellites having a common mass. That's basically what it is. Okay, it's basically saying that all the satellites like to live essentially the same sort of halos. And there's a whole bunch of these halos in a numerical simulation of something like the Milky Way. No problem. You can put them in. So the problem isn't that you can't find halos to host these galaxies. The problem is something a little different.
Your ability to fit this curve presupposes that all of these galaxies are dark matter dominant.
Yeah.
Because you've not asked how much does the luminous contribute to the velocity. And is there
For all of these guys, it's tiny, right? I mean, these things have like 300, like this guy has 300 solar luminosities. I mean, talking about, if you infer the dark matter mass, you're talking about a factor of 100 to 1,000, right? So these are, like this guy is basically, I think, the most dark matter dominated galaxy known.
Don't you have to worry about these objects being virialized because they're going around and elliptical orbit. They have to go through the center of the galaxy.
They don't have to go through the center of the galaxy, but yes, they come reasonably, yeah. So it's fairly easy to estimate for most of them, you know, what kind of orbits do you need so that they don't get disrupted.
If you have tidal forces not realized, then it's been published.
I know.
That M over L is seriously distorted.
Yeah, yeah.
So in order to verify or not verify this, you have to be able to see any distortion. It's very difficult.
It is. So this is... so again, like if you're interested, this paper goes through it in gory detail about that. No. In this case, trust me, we go through this in great detail about what will happen to this galaxy if it was being tidally distorted. So we look for, you know, any gradients in the velocity. You don't find anything. And this is a reasonable system for a faint guy. We have 70 stars in this. But more importantly, if you just put this in one of these dark matter halos, there's no way it gets tidally distorted.
Yeah, but you just put it into a dark matter halo.
Yeah, it doesn't get...
So you presuppose what's happening.
Yeah, so let me back up and say what I'm saying, right? This is completely consistent with sitting in one of these dark matter subhalos, which is what we said. And there's no evidence for any sort of distortions that you get from tidal effects. The kind you see in, for example, some of these globulars that are very close to the center. I mean, that's the stage where we left it at in this paper.
The paper's published by Howard Troop and his group. Have you read this paper?
I have read, and I've had like lots of email conversations, and I'm not going to talk about it right now. We can talk about it offline. I don't agree with like anything he says, but. We can discuss this after the talk. Well, anything he says about the Milky Way satellites, he obviously is he knows his stuff about other things. So what is the issue here? The issue here is. Now instead of plotting the density and just plotting the mass, it's the same thing. If you divide by the volume, you get the density. These black points are the data for only the bright ones. I haven't plotted the faint guys. And now what's plotted on here are lines. Are essentially they just subhalos you take from the simulation, okay? And in this case, I'm doing a cheat. I'm just plotting the fits to it. But in the paper, we don't do that. We just take the particle data and plot the mass. It doesn't change anything. What you see here is that there's a whole bunch of, so this is like ranked by the most massive. So this is about like 20, might be 25, most massive subhalos in Aquarius simulation. Aquarius is a simulation is a series where they're looking at halos that look like, you know, the halos of the Milky Way. Sort of in the mass range of for the halos of the Milky Way, and what you see here is that there's a whole bunch of things here on top here that are not consistent with hosting any of these bright satellites. Okay, so if you stare at this, what you realize is the fact that there's a whole bunch here that goes through these points is not as important as the fact that there is a whole bunch which are massive but don't go through that point. Right? So So you ask yourself, what happened to those subhalos, right? If this simulation, this Aquarian simulation, is really a good proxy for what the Milky Way halo looks like, then you have to answer the question, what happened to these massive guys? What happened to these subhalos? Why did they not light up, right? Why is it that something less massive lights up, but something here doesn't light up? And this is completely at odds with what we found in galaxy formation on larger scales. On larger scales, we always find that, you know, that as, you know, the larger mass halos have essentially more stars. I mean, there's a one-to-one correlation, and it works really well. Something's breaking down here. Okay, and it's not just an issue of missing satellites. It's really a density problem. So this is plotting the number of satellites, the log of the number of satellites. So this is 10, 100,000, 10,000. These are the things that are consistent with hosting the known satellites, right? So this is just the bright guys here. These two points here are the large and the small Magellanic clouds. Okay, the dots are the things in the simulation. The black ones are the subhalos in the simulation that are not consistent with hosting any of these satellites. And so what you see is that there's a clear discrepancy here, which I'm not too worried about. I'll tell you in just a second. But there's also a discrepancy here. Okay, it almost looks like there's a gap there, right? And these are, you know, the massive failures, the too big to fail, right? What happened to them? The reason they're more troublesome than sort of the canonical missing satellite problem is that we know that there are feedback effects that will sort of, you know, make sure that something this massive here is, you know, doesn't light up, right? There are reasonable feedback effects. There might be a problem there too, I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying that there are reasonable feedback prescriptions that has nothing to do with the stellar content of the galaxy. It has just to do with the UV background that will sort of kill star formation out here. The main worry is what's happening out here, right? And that's, it's very simple, but that's really the too big to fail problem. So what are the possible solutions? I think the most prosaic one, the one that has merited, I think pretty much everything that people have talked about in terms of solving this problem has to do with this one, which is the Aquarius simulation is not a good example of what the Milky Way looks like. The Milky Way halo is much less massive than Aquarius. So Aquarius simulations had a mass for the Milky Way in the range of 0.9 to 2 times 10 to the 12. And I think that's completely reasonable. But the if you knock down this mass, what did I do? No, this is, so this is, it should be 1.9 times 10 to the 12, sorry. Or is that right, 0.9? I need to look this up, but it's a factor of two range, but I'm not exactly sure what the lower range is. Yeah, I guess it's almost there, yeah. But if you go down a little bit more, like about 30, 40% more than this, then what ends up happening is essentially you don't see those massive guys, right? So if you keep lowering the mass of the Milky Way, you know, if you start, as you start lowering, the big ones disappear because there's a direct correlation between the biggest subhalo and the mass of the halo, right? So if you keep lowering the mass of the Milky Way, eventually you will kill off all of these guys, right? You won't have any of these massive subhalos. But here's the problem with that. You won't even have LMC and SMC, right? If you kill off everything here, then you don't get to put LMC and SMC in something. So what happened to the large and the small Magellanic clouds? I mean, they are there, right? So then you end up, you know, you end up with this problem where you have to explain why the Milky Way mass is so low and yet you see the Magellanic clouds in the sky. It's also not consistent with this other satellite, LEO 1, which is around 240 kpc, and it's like moving really fast. And so if you make the Milky Way mass too small, then that LEO 1 is no longer bound. Okay, and that's, again, very rare in numerical simulations. We know that from Millennium. Yeah?
How do you know that large Magellanic clouds form in the outer
That's right. So this is based on actually looking at it. In fact, they don't form in the Milky Way. So this is based on looking at the Millennium simulations and asking how many analogs of the Large and the Small Magellanic Clouds, actually just the Large Magellanic Cloud, can you find? And if they're not bound, how rare are they? And they're just incredibly rare, right? And Millennium is a huge simulation, so you can play this game. So Mike Bolan-Colchin was the first author on this. He's analyzed Millennium 2, right? So that's the way you make these arguments. But you're absolutely right. They don't form in, they fall in. Then there's direct measurements of halo stars from Sloan that basically argue for the same mass. You can look at local circular velocity measurements. There's a couple of other things I haven't gone over, but everything is consistent with, like, 10 to the 12. So if you want to knock down the mass of the Milky Way, you've got to make sure that, a lot of these things are wrong. And that just seems unlikely to me. Okay? You can also just say the Milky Way is an outlier, just live with it, who cares? And that's fine, except there's also Andromeda, which is the next closest galaxy, and there's their satellites, the Andromeda satellites, also show the same behavior. Okay, the third thing is really probably the most, the thing that's had a lot of, work in the last couple of years, which is, what about feedback? If you have stars forming in these galaxies, in these satellites, and stars become supernovae, supernova has 10 to the 51 ergs of kinetic energy. The kinetic energy, as it goes through the interstellar medium, it will interact with the gas. So it'll impart some of its kinetic energy to the gas. That will blow the gas out. If gas dominates the potential, and as you clear the gas, the dark matter should follow. Okay, and it seems like a lot of steps one behind the other, but it actually works. I mean, all you have to do is change the potential in the center by a reasonable amount, and you will eject some of the dark matter. It'll get unbound. But the problem is, and this is again something that's contentious. You should also talk to the people whose work I'm going to deprecate here. But these blowout scenarios, I don't think work effectively in satellites. So what we did is the following. And so in this paper, we looked at this. We did something very simple. We took a halo, and this is plotting the velocity as a function of radius. Okay, so that look at the solid curve, and that's the Vmax, about 35. And then what we did is we put in the center, and let's look at this dotted curve. We put about 10 to the 8 solar masses of stuff in the center and just blew it out. And what that did is turned this black curve into this dotted curve. Okay, and you can see there's less dark matter in the center. Here's all the observations, right? So by doing that, you make this sort of consistent with this point, data point, right? But that data point is Draco. It's the least luminous, or I think one of the least luminous of the bright satellites. There's about 10 to the 5 solar masses of stuff. So you have a system where you have 10 to the 5 solar masses of stuff, and you want to blow out 10 to the 8 solar masses of stuff. Okay, really extreme, right? The thing which has the most mass in stars is Fornax, which is this, right? And this doesn't get close to Fornax. But this is not just me telling you. There was a simulation done, or there's a whole series of simulations done by Fabio Governado and collaborators. And what they found is actually, I think, very similar. Okay, so now this on this axis is this alpha. So alpha is just the slope of this parameter. So it's the log slope of the density. Right. They're trying to measure that at some radius, 500 parsec. Doesn't really matter. What matters is that this solid line is the prediction of CDM. There's some scatter around it. The crosses are basically simulation results. This x-axis is this amount of stars in that galaxy. Okay. So this is 10 to the 7, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 5, 4, 3. This is 10 to the 7. Below 10 to the 7, they see no difference, meaning whether this blowout, this feedback happens or not, they don't see much of a difference. Okay, the density profile looks the same as it would have without the stars. Above about 10 to the 8, they start seeing differences. And the differences go in the direction you want. It goes in the direction of making things more shallow. Okay? All the Milky Way satellites, the dwarfs I'm talking about, except for the large and the small Magellanic clouds, which were excluded from all of these comparisons, are below here. Right? So what these simulations are telling you is that the star formation happening in the Milky Way satellites just doesn't have enough oomph to do any damage to the dark matter halo. Right? That's just reading off this plot. I don't see how feedback is going to solve the problem of the massive satellites.
So I'm puzzled. Usually feedback effects are more important for less massive objects, but it seems that...
Because the feedback is correlated to the amount of stars you form. Right? So that's the issue here, right?
But still, what happens? But you're saying at low masses...
At low stellar masses, you're forming fewer stars, fewer supernova, less energy in feedback.
But you compare that to the depth of the potential.
Exactly. So but the determining thing is still the stellar mass. Right? That's what they find. And that's what we found too in that simple blowout scenario. And their scenario is not simple at all. I mean, it's a full-fledged hydrodynamic simulations where you have like multiple episodes of feedback. So my take on this is I don't think this is going to work. Also because the simulations are sort of pushed to the edge, right? They are, in these simulations, you couple like the majority, I mean, like maybe 50% of the kinetic energy of the supernova into the ISM, right? There isn't any other place for this to go. I mean, I think this is sort of the maximum effect you can get.
I'm missing something in the picture. Yeah. These are basically spherical galaxies. Is the blowout velocity below the escape velocity? So presumably the material in the inside gets blown into the outside, but still in the galaxy, which means you should be above NFW in the outer region and below NFW in the inner region.
It's a good question. So, no, they're not spherical galaxies because these are full-fledged hydrodynamic simulations. So they are all triaxial.
Oh, they're not spirals. You're not blowing stuff out.
No. And in fact, the thing with this is that is amazing about this work and that makes it so hard is that if you degrade the resolution of the simulations a little bit, then none of this effect happens. So in order to resolve the physics that's happening, which is anyway put in by hand, but still, you have to actually do this very high resolution simulations. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. Anyway, so I think this is great. I mean, this is really amazing work, but it's still sort of starting. And even for these guys, I have my doubts, and they're mainly, I'll just say this, but for people who can talk to me later who know about this, most of these points here are this is 500 parsec. The softening lens for these simulations is, just for people who know, is like 170 parsec for a lot of these points. How do you actually resolve a core which is less than 4 or 5 softening length? I don't know. So I think these are really hard simulations, and this group has clearly made huge progress in this direction in the last year. But there's ways to go. So all I'm telling you is I have my doubts that they're going to explain all of this, and I certainly don't think they're going to explain the Milky Way satellites. Okay, let's see. So I have about 8 minutes. Okay, so what I'm going to do is then try to go through this self-interaction. Let me just put up the slide here. So the thing that I like the most about this problem is I think it's pointing to, basically something different from cold dark matter. Okay, and this is not new. A lot of things in cosmology is cyclical. If you had asked Spergel and Steinhardt, if they were giving this talk in 2000, apart from this massive satellite problem, they would have been talking about the missing satellite problem. It would have been sort of similar slides. Okay, So things just come and go. I don't think warm dark matter does it, and that's my personal view that if you add an extra parameter, it should do more than just one thing. You know, it should try to solve the problem on multiple scales. But again, that's a very subjective view. You could take the point of view that warm dark matter solves the satellite problem and everything else is feedback. And in fact, that's been shown that a warm dark matter can actually solve the satellite problem. This is Carlos Frank and collaborators. But my favorite right now, the thing that I'm really excited about is self-interacting dark matter model, and I'll try to show you in the next couple few slides why that is. And there's a whole bunch of work that happened recently that got me and other people interested in it, and we can talk about this offline. Okay, so here's the sort of my empirical solution to this whole core size versus halo mass problem. Remember this plot I showed you, Vmax versus Rmax? The only thing I've done in this plot is I've put a 0.1 there. Okay? I just multiply that Rmax by 0.1, and I'm going to call that the core radius. Now if you look, the satellites, and if you just draw vertical lines here, you go from, let's say, 20 to 50, you're going from around 0.2, 0.3 to about 1 kPc. The right scales to modify the properties of the satellites, because the half-life radio of the satellites are all in that range. For the spirals, if you draw a line here, it goes from like around less than a kPc to about 5 kPc or so. So again, the scatter is really important, right? It's a large range in radio. And for clusters, if you just drop this up there, you'll find it's around 10 to 50 kPc. So by just putting a 0.1, you sort of get the right scales. And I've put question marks against clusters and satellites because remember, in all the things I showed you, I never really discussed whether the satellites have a core or not. All I said is the density is lower. That doesn't automatically imply that the density flattens off, right? Although there are observations now that tell you that seem to be pointing to in that direction too. Same thing with clusters. And with clusters, I think it's a matter of analysis. People haven't really looked for cores. But in any case, if there are cores, it's going to be on those scales, right? So this is giving you all the right size cores. And very quickly, what I'm going to show you is that if you had self-interactions with a cross-section of about 0.1 bonds, so cross-section over mass of around 0.1 bonds per GeV, roughly in that ballpark, like within factors of 2 or so, maybe 3, then you do get this, okay? So the next 3 or 4 slides are about self-interactions. We've run a bunch of simulations where the dark matter is interacting with itself. It's very simple model. This is just elastic scattering, velocity independent, just plain elastic scattering between the dark matter particles. And the simulations we ran were a bunch of different cross sections. We ran for one, you know, we ran one bond per GeV, we ran 0.1 bond per GeV, and something in the middle. We couldn't quite resolve everything at 0.1 bond, but we resolved everything you need to resolve at one bond per GeV. What's impressive is that, again, this is not meant, this makes sense to people who've seen this before, but it's meant to tell you that there are two lines there. One is CDM, one is SIDM, and they overlap over the regions where you can resolve it. And this is the correlation function of dark matter. That is the mass function of dark matter at different redshifts. Basically, on large scales, SIDM and CDM look identical. So anything that you thought was a success for CDM works for SIDM. I can't find any difference on these scales, right? Going back all the way to Z of 6.
There might be still a difference. In the bullet cluster, the two clusters go through each other, and the idea is that the dark matters don't interact.
Ask me at the end of the talk.
There's a limit on how big cross sections.
Right. Ask me at the end. I'll certainly. Okay. So on large scales, there's no issues, but on small scales, there will be differences. Well, this is just things we did to test the code. So you've seen observational, sort of plots of this. This is velocity versus radius for 6 different halos. The black line is CDM. The green ones are SIDM with 0.1 bonds. This is one bond. Okay, and you can start, in this case, you can clearly resolve the linear one. Here you can start to resolve the linearize. Okay, so it's just telling you that it's going to form a core. And here's the core. This is density as a function of radius, and you can clearly see that it flattens off. And we've cut this off sort of at a point where we can't resolve the simulations any further. We've used very conservative criteria for like cutting it off. And you have to be conservative for one reason. Because if you have numerical artifacts, they do exactly the same thing as self-interactions. Like, for example, if you have two-body gravitational interactions, it's going to clear out the center and make cores. So you have to be very careful in these simulations not to push things too far in. Okay, so clearly you start seeing differences, and these are the cores. Okay, and let me just put up the main plot. So here's the core radius versus Rmax, essentially. That same plot. And you can see now why I was saying that it's basically a straight line. The core radius is directly proportional to this Rmax in these self-interaction simulations. For one bond per GeV, the core radii turns out to be too big. For 0.1 bond per GeV, we think it's right in the ballpark. It's that 0.1 Rmax number, and it should explain most of these things. And at 0.1 bond per GeV, there's no constraints from bullet cluster or anything else. The constraints from bullet cluster are at the 1 bond per GeV level, okay? Which are in any case wrong. If you want to ask me about it later on. Okay. So I think I'll end with this. I hope I've shown you that there are issues. And more than anything, I wanted to tell you that the observations are at a very interesting stage right now. And a lot of these things will go forward. You will see probably more systems. So keep an eye out for them. And you're looking in the inner parts of these galaxies. And I think SIDM actually does a wonderful job of explaining the small scale problems while keeping all the successes on large scale. So this should be seriously considered for future work. Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Anders. I guess, as I said at the beginning, Manuel will be here for a few weeks, and it's obviously V69 questions. Yeah.
Can I just repeat that previous question? How does your cross section compare to the bullet cluster limits?
Yeah, so the bullet cluster limits come from a bunch of different things. One of the constraints, which is I think the strongest constraint, is that if you look at the centroid of the line and the centroid of the total mass from the event, they're slightly offset. Right? You know, you can put a limit on how offset they are. And if you think about self-interactions as that cluster falls in, the self-interactions only affect the dark matter, not the stars. So you do expect some small difference, right, between the two. And that limit is at 0.7, so maybe it's useful to write this down. That limit is sigma or m around 0.7 centimeters per program, which is roughly bond, 0.7 bond per GeV. Okay. But I think those limits are wrong for the following reason. When the constraints were made, they were done with constraint simulations. So what they did was to throw in a halo which they thought might be like a self-interacting halo into another big one that they thought might be like. But both of those halos, given what we've done now, go way too dense. Make sense? So because the halos that they simulated were too dense, the effects they get are going to be larger. Right? So as it is, the solution I'm talking about isn't constrained by the bullet cluster. But I think this would be off by a factor of two. So I think the real limit is probably around 2. We would have to really do this carefully in a simulation. It's not easy.
So, sorry, just a quick follow-up on that. I guess a related thing you could look for with a larger number of simulations would be what the largest velocities you get are for the largest satellites. So the Magellanic Cloud equivalents at the self-interaction at some level should slow them down or be a drag force or something on them. So you'd think there'd be some limit for that.
Possibly. So there was an analytic argument from Oleg Medin, the constructor, where they were talking about basically, I mean, essentially the whole dark matter getting stripped off the stars. We've checked that stripping doesn't happen up to the group scales, but our box is not big enough to like do the cluster. So it would be really interesting to do this for clusters and see. Their limits were around, I think, 0.5, but they were analytic. I didn't have time to go through this, but there's a second paper we're writing on just the observational aspect comparing to like beam lensing. And essentially all the analytic arguments were like wrong by sometimes factors of 2, sometimes factors of 10. And I know, in a bunch of those papers I use those analytic arguments. So you just have to do the simulation at this point. You really get constraints at that level.
Let's talk about AIMO520. Well,
it's on the list cluster.
It's the anti-cluster cluster.
Ah, okay, there's a whole bunch of, yeah.
So your paper came out, and that'll be pushed.
Oh, now I've already done that, yeah.
And there's a dark club in the center, it's really close. Then there's a paper by 12 masses out, which came out saying they don't agree with cluster and the Dali now. So according to private communication, they claim they're right. This is a serious problem. If you have this dark center for your lens, it's not supposed to be there, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, if it's there, then it's great for some interactions, right?
But you can't have, you see, on the one hand, you're trying to buy into cluster, which we've been hearing about for years. Every time you hear a dark matter talk, up comes the Kuiper cluster slide. Now you have to put up a 520 slide. Okay? You can't buy into both of these things. Someone has to be wrong.
They don't have to, and I won't say anymore because I'm writing a paper on it, but I'll just say that in the context of self-interactions, you would expect, depending on the orbit, you would expect some of these orphan systems, because self-interactions do exactly that, right? It basically, the dark matter is interacting with the halo, but the stars are not. So you would tend to like, if the thing went around a few times, you would strip the stars of the halo, and you would see exactly this. Right? So,
but why do you stick dark matter to the halo 520 and not go to
the halo? I'm not going to say anymore. Because I'm writing a paper working. But I think it's an excellent.
Yeah, the limit from the bullet cluster, I thought the simplest limit they get to with that is just looking at the positions of the galaxy centroids versus the weak lensing peak.
Yes.
So that doesn't rely on any simulating at all.
No, it does, right? Because you in order to back out and ask how strong the interaction should be to create that centroid. Right?
Well, the offset between the two, but I mean, all you need to look for is that there is an offset.
But then how do you put a constraint? How do you put a number? Sigma or
M. But there is an offset between the two, so you do actually produce some kind of limit, I thought.
Yeah, but you have to back, you know, so taking that offset, right? So they have a delta X, right? And now you need to ask, like, what cross sections can produce this delta X? Or what cross sections will overproduce this? To do that, they have to run simulations.
But so you're saying that the mass ratio they choose between the two clusters is not correct?
No. But the density in the central part for the halos they choose is way too dense compared to what you can see.
Right.
Does that make sense? So for the same mass of the halo, you need to figure out what the density profile is, right? So they use some isothermal density profile. Looks like that, right?
Yes.
But this part here is way too dense compared to what you would get for in a simulation with sigma over M of 1. Then you overproduce the effect.
It's not self-consistent.
They didn't do a self-consistent self-interaction simulation. It was a constrained simulation where they threw one blob into another blob, and they did a best guess of what the blob should look like, in a sense, they're tracking down.
So you should have constraints from the lensing directly, like fiddle on top down.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether that's what they use, but.
So that's the interesting, that's a great point. So that's the interesting bit that in this paper we say is that the delta x isn't really the biggest constraint. If you just look at just the densities, like you're saying, the sigma over m of 1 produces densities that are way too low to be consistent with the measured densities.
Sorry, if 1?
Sigma, oh, sorry, 1 centimeters.
1 in your units, okay.
So this thing is ruled out.
Okay.
But it's ruled out not by the canonical Hewlett cluster argument, it's ruled out by measurement of densities. On all scales, actually, not just on cluster scales. It's just too efficient at reducing the densities.
So,
did you
have a question?
Yeah.
Go for it. Okay, Nate.
I was just wondering, so there's this fact that if the Milky Way satellite and the stars and the dark matter halo are both, the dwarf halo are both just falling under the same gravitational potential, that the tidal tails are predicted to be basically almost perfectly symmetric, the forward tail and back tail are the same. And Mike Kasdan and Mark Kamikowski got a rather good constraint, do you think that this fact that the dark matter has been a strongly interacting dark matter model, that the dark matter halo would feel a headwind passing through the Milky Way's halo would produce, like you might think there would be to some extent an apparent lengthening of the forward tail relative to the backward tail?
It's possible. I mean, I didn't like back of the envelope, I didn't get a large effect, but given that all of the back of the envelopes were wrong by factors of few, it's possible that there might be something like that. I know Lydia Williams had like a couple of papers on this talking about this exact effect. But yeah, I haven't looked at it in detail.
Yes, sir. But is there actually a particle physics realization which has a velocity independent cross section, but cross section which is one of an atomic size section?
I mean, you know, any of these Hewlett sector models, like you just take a Hewlett sector and like you know, put something like that.
Yeah, but you want a velocity independent cross section.
But the neutron programs. The neutron
it's a barn, right? It's a barn, or then barn.
That's this exactly what you need. So you need a barn for a GEV mass barn.
But you're saying sigma over M is like one barn per GEV.
That's exactly what they said. That's what the Steiner thing was. It was like the dark matter is, you know, a bunch of neutrons which are not neutrons, but let's say protons. That was the model. So The problem with these Hewlett sector models is that you know you could write them down, but then so the coupling to a lone sector is just a free thing. Like when you this doesn't tell you anything about how it couples to a lone sector.
Yeah, but if you have proton scattering, the cross section is a millibar. So
yes.
Getting up to barn or tens of barns, you need an atomic size cross section.
Right. So you basically need some.
They're not just self interacting, they're strongly interacting.
They're strongly interacting. Yeah. Yeah.
But that was the original proposal.
That was the original proposal. It's a composite particle for sure, right? And I can see any reason why it can't be that high.
So Phil had a question that I did.
If I followed you, I mean, the self-interacting dark matter will solve the core problem that you're getting in the Milky Way satellites, but doesn't solve the missing satellite.
That's right. That's the interesting bit about this is it doesn't actually, or at least up to the resolution we can say, you can't go up to like 20 kilometers per second. The mass function, meaning the amount of satellites at a given mass, seems to not be different from CDM.
Yeah.
But that is not an issue that needs to be solved, the missing satellite problem.
I'm sorry, you were talking a lot about why they don't light up.
Yes, so then I'm
saying that's
the problem.
It needs to be solved or does not need to be solved.
No, there are two different problems. I tried to like decouple this, but they're completely two different. I'll just put
right. When you say that it's half the two that fail,
that's so. There are two problems, right? One
yes.
is the problem here, the other one is this.
Yes.
This is called the missing satellite problem. This is the new thing you're pointing out.
Yes.
Right? It most likely solves this. So everything we've done seems to indicate that it will solve this. Normally, it's not standing here and saying, exactly does solve this is because the resolution in our simulation wasn't good enough to get down to these scales. Right? But there were other simulations done by Vogelsberg as a lambda and Flow that basically said the same thing. This is the missing standard problem. And SIBM doesn't seem to do anything here. I mean, but I can't really say much more because the simulations can't really push past this point. But my best case estimate is it doesn't do anything. But we don't need to solve this problem.
Are we really sure that the dark satellites don't exist?
No. That's why it doesn't need to solve it. I mean, that's
the question of why they light up depends on what you think they were supposed to do. But the question of whether or not they exist is a question. I mean, is there no lensing evidence in their favor or against their existence?
No.
Yeah, so as I remember back from the early 2000s, it was the shapes of galaxies that killed.
That's right. I didn't go into it because,
Self-interacting dark matter. So,
So this has a little bit of, let me just take 1 minute to say this, a little bit of history, but so one reason I think why people stopped thinking about self-interaction was this very influential paper by Jody Miller-Lespire talking about the shapes measured from strong lensing. In a cluster. And the shapes were decidedly looking, right? They were not spherical. One of the things that self-interaction does is it produces the central parts becomes very spherical, and you don't have to really see anything except this one plot. Once the density profile starts flattening off, clearly things have to be spherical. Right? That's the new solution. So in the inner parts, And so this is going to come out very soon. This is a two-part paper. The second part, we're only discussing the shapes. Basically, outside this region here, it looks sort of like NFW in standard CDM. Inside part, the shape is, it's almost spherical. But turns out that is not inconsistent with these clusters, even for sigma over n 1. And the issue is that what you always measure is the ellipticity of the projected mass, right? And for some reason, Jody did, and I've written papers that predict really strong constraints based on shapes from elliptical galaxies. None of this really stopped and thought about, well, it's really only the local shape that becomes spherical, right? So for example, when you measure the mass in a cylinder, most of your mass is coming from outside the central region. Now, that's not spherical. And so if you just plot the shapes as a function of mass or something like that, you do this very carefully, you realize that that cluster that you want to use doesn't really rule it out. So it's like, but there are other shape measurements and group scales that again disfavor something like 1 cm². But no shape argument is going to tell you that 0.1 is ruled out for the following reason. If you make a core which is much smaller than RS, then all your mass in the cylinder is dominated by stuff outside.
So you can appear elliptical in projection, but still be spherical in the
center. Exactly, yeah. And if you use like arguments from X-rays, which I've used, they're also wrong because there, you're measuring the potential, the shape of the potential, which is again an integrated point. Right, so we don't really have any, as far as I can tell, there's no local shape measurement. People are thinking about bi-hour moments in strong lensing, and that's something I'm really interested in talking about. There's really no local method.
One other question about the too big to fail. So another solution that was proposed, I think, Carlos Frank and collaborators, was that not, aside from the Milky Way being smaller than Aquarius, but that something's weird about Aquarius. They did a self-similar analysis using like Millennium, and Millennium 2, that basically those simulations, of course, don't have high enough resolution, but you just scale down basically their clusters to predict how much subhalos a galaxy should have. Aquarius seems to predict a lot more.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts or comments. How much do you trust Aquarius as not a strange simulation?
That's the only thing that we had available, is all I'd say, right? But we also have to be elective to use that when it doesn't change.
The the field actually has less substructure.
Has less, and it, the answer doesn't change. I mean, you know, so we did both the electric field and the coils. So, and then my colleague James Bullock is now running a whole suite of them, and nothing seems to change. So there is bound to be scatter, you know, from Halo to Halo.
I remember in the Aquarius, because they have six halos at medium, at pretty good resolution, and they were saying that their six were all systematically higher in substructure than Bialacta. And they were accusing that obviously something went wrong with Bialacta, but could something systematically be wrong with Aquarius?
You know, my gut feeling is no, because I think a lot of this has to do with resolution. If you don't have enough resolution, then funny things can happen. Satellites can get disrupted. So at the end of the day, I mean, the problem with Bialacta might be a little different cosmology. I don't know. It does have a higher sigma 8, and that does tend to produce more satellites. But Bialacta has the opposite end, and much lower than WMAP7, and it didn't change anything. So I don't know. I mean, like I said, one of our solutions was to just scatter this little bit. Maybe that's
so one last burning question, and I guess John.
Quick comment. Galaxies, the cores of galaxies, barriers must be velocity dispersions, Newtonian until you get out of that.
Yeah, that's why I said you have to cherry pick these systems where they are not important. Yeah. So most of them you can't.
If you include barriers, you have to solve that random problem. This is a provision as books. Putting the barriers expanding into non-linear trouble. So, there have been papers on this, including the consultant, as a protocol within the
barrier. Well, let me just, so maybe you missed what I said, but these systems were chosen, so, but these systems, like, there were just a handful of these spiral galaxies that looked at, they were all chosen because there's like very little barriers. Like, you cherry pick them. You look out of the, you know, hundreds of thousands of galaxies, you look for the 10, 20 that have very little barriers, and then you look at these systems.
But the velocity dispersion is total. So it comes out of the core.
So sorry, but that's the continuing discussion over lunch. I know everybody's welcome to join us.